Good morning, everybody. I assume I'm unmuted. You can hear me. If you give me a thumbs up, that I'll be able to see that. All right. Well, thanks for the invitation to be here today. As Sal mentioned, there have been many chapters in my professional life over the years. Most of you know me from when I was the MP for Halliburton Quartz Lake Sprock. But before and after that, I spent a lot of time in academia. And when I was a graduate student back in the 1980s, my one area of specialization was American politics, government, and elections. And so probably a year ago, I guess, I first talked to Sal about this. Some of you may recall I made a presentation a couple of years ago to do with Korea and kind of the situation on the Korean Peninsula. But I had mentioned a year ago that another group had asked me if I could explain how American elections work. This, you know, a year or so ago before the American election, there was a lot of interest in it. And I agreed at that time to do it, but I agreed to do it in the context that I would explain kind of the mechanics and the machinery of elections, as opposed to having a political conversation about whether I liked or didn't like the particular candidate. So that's what I'm going to do today. And if you have questions, I would just ask if you could hold them until the end, and I will leave plenty of time at that point. Now, I'm going to try to share my screen here with you.
It's working.
All right. It's working? Okay, I'm going to shut off all my little cameras, but I can't see any of you anymore. But I'm presuming that all of you can now see a screen that says Understanding American Elections. Is that correct?
Yep.
Okay, perfect. Today I want to talk about the machinery of American elections. When I was a graduate school, I completed my master's and started on a PhD back in the 80s at Stony Brook University, which is on Long Island, New York. And I actually taught a course on American government and elections. My American students used to find it kind of ironic that they actually had a Canadian professor. But basically, I've taken the parts around American elections and kind of, as I said, taken an entire undergraduate course and tried to cram it into 45 minutes. So the first question is, I guess, why should Canadians care about elections in the United States? I think the answer is, you know, the United States is the most powerful nation on earth. What they do affects the rest of us. Pierre Trudeau once said that living beside the United States is like sleeping with an elephant. Every twitch and movement of the beast is potentially fatal to us. And we all know that's true as Canadians. That what happens in the US does impact Canada and the rest of the world. The second part is Canada and the United States appear very similar in many ways, kind of superficially. When people travel here from abroad, they often mention that. But the truth is there's some pretty significant differences, and one of them has to do with the way that government works in the two countries. Now, if I'm going to try to explain how the machinery of American elections work, the question becomes, do you guys need to understand Canadian government elections too? And in a word, yes. It's very helpful to me if we have some shared frame of reference. And I'll give you a couple of examples. Back in the 80s, when I taught a course on American government and elections in New York, almost all my students were like 18 or 19 year old Americans. Most of them didn't know much about their own politics, and they knew nothing about the rest of the world. So I had kind of nothing to compare it to. So that made it a challenge to try to explain it to them. More recently, 4 or 5 years ago, when I was teaching a similar course at Sejong University in South Korea, I had students from around the world. Probably only about 10% of the students were Korean, but they came from all over the place. So they had a different frame of reference, but they didn't have a shared frame of reference. So when I wanted to come up with an example of how something worked in US politics, you know, some days I would compare it to Korea, some days I would try to compare it to India or to China or Russia, where many of the countries that those students came from, which was kind of a different kind of a challenge. So by comparison, I would say that today's a piece of cake because everybody in this room is Canadian and you've all have a general understanding of how government and elections work in Canada. So that gives me something to compare and contrast the American system with. As I say at the bottom, please note, I'm not suggesting that everything in Canada works well or works at all, but at least you have a general understanding of it. Here's how I'm going to do this. If you're a football fan, if you're a Canadian football fan, you watch both the CFL and the NFL. But it's interesting. Have you ever tried to explain the difference between the CFL and the NFL to an American, right? So imagine you are down in Florida and you have a friend, an American friend down there who's a big football fan. So he really understands the NFL game, but he really has never watched the CFL. And he's confounded and confused with three downs instead of four and a 55-yard line and 12 players instead of 11, wider, longer field. But at least if you're explaining the CFL to him, you can always compare it back to the way it is in the NFL. He understands that. On the other hand, imagine trying to explain the CFL to somebody who's never watched football at all before. It would be far more complicated to explain football in general to someone, let's say from Europe, that's never watched the game. So I'm presuming what I'm going to do today is explain the NFL to a CFL fan. And I think that this should work pretty well. So let's talk about the United States. The United States was created back on the 4th of July, 1776. We all kind of know the story. There were 13 British colonies along the east coast of what's now the United States. They were increasingly frustrated with London kind of telling them what to do. The famous no taxation without representation line was used. And in 1776, these upstart colonies decided to declare their independence from the United Kingdom, from England at that time. Now, in the last couple hundred years, this kind of thing has happened many times, but it was unprecedented in 1776. The notion that a bunch of ragtag colonies would actually stand up and say, you know what, we're going to form our own country and we're no longer going to be a colony. But that is, in fact, what the Americans did in 1776. Now, at that time in 1776, the Americans actually came up with a form of government, but it didn't work very well. And 11 years later, they actually rewrote the rules of government in the United States in the summer of 1787, and actually at that time created what is now the Constitution of the United States. So some of you may, over the years, may have been a bit concerned, you know, the Declaration of Independence is 1776. How is it that the Constitution wasn't until 11 years later? Well, the reason was the first system, the Articles of Confederation that were delivered back in 1776 didn't work. I would make a general statement that if you want to understand Americans in the United States, you need to start with the presumption that they basically don't like government. Basically, most Americans, their perfect world would be no government at all. And so they see government as a necessary evil rather than something that's desirable. And while they will grudgingly acknowledge that sometimes you need a government, they don't like that. And so what their belief is that, well, if we're going to have a government, let's keep it as small as possible. This is kind of what I'd call a small C conservative idea. We see this in Canada as well in political debates in Ottawa and in Toronto, where the conservatives instinctively kind of want less government, kind of less intervention, fewer rules, lower taxes. Whereas those kind of left of center, so in Canada, maybe Liberals or NDPers, they view government as a positive force that actually does good things in society. So they don't see it as a necessary evil. They actually see it as a beneficial force in society. And also as Canadians, we often compare ourselves with Americans. And if we try to figure out in Canada kind of where the center of politics is, and we compare it to the US, I think it's fair to say that the American center is further to the right than in Canada. Just as a group, Americans are a little less trustful of government and want less kind of interference in their lives. So when these delegates met initially in 1776, they said, let's create a really, really, really weak government, national government, and let's have the states keep control over most of the important stuff. Though 10 years later, they realized that it just wasn't working. It was too weak. So in 1787, they said, okay, we need to create a stronger central government, but not too strong. And what they came up with at that time is the system that we now see today in the United States. One of the key concepts of the American government is that it's a federation, not a unitary state. So most countries in the world, places like the United Kingdom, places like South Korea, where I was, it's a unitary state, which basically means there's one level of government that does most of the stuff. There could be some lower levels, counties or states, but they don't have much power. It's usually larger countries, geographically larger countries that have a federation where there's a bunch of members who have autonomy at kind of a regional level, but also have a national government. Canada's a federation. The United States is a federation. Russia is a federation. Australia is a federation. But smaller countries like Korea or Japan or Belgium or Poland or lots of other places around the world, Vietnam, are smaller. That basically there's one level of government that runs everything. And in the United States, they've kind of taken this to an extreme, which is that they've tried to keep absolutely as much power as possible in the hands of the states and as little as possible in Ottawa. And certainly that's the way it started 200 years ago. Over the last couple of centuries, there has been a migration of power from the state level to the national level. If George Washington or George Madison could see this situation in the United States today, they would be surprised how much power is in the national government. But still, compared to lots of other countries, it's a relatively low level. When the Americans sat down to figure out how their government would work, one of the first things they had to decide is that they were going to have a national legislature, what we now know as the Congress, the House of Representatives. How would you hand out the seats? Would the seats be handed out on the basis of population, or would they be handed out on the basis of so many seats per member? So in Canada, for example, in our national parliament, we use the principle of representation by population. So in Canada, each federal riding is about 110,000 people. That's why there's lots more of them in Ontario than there are in Manitoba or Prince Edward Island. But there are other organizations like the United Nations where there's one seat per member. So Belgium has one seat, France has one seat, the United States has one seat, right? So in the United Nations, you get one seat per member. It's not representation by population. Whereas in something like the Canadian Parliament, we use representation by population. Even on a more local level, I know I don't want to open any old wounds here, but in the former county of Victoria, you know, you had a county council and each of the lower level municipalities got one seat on county council, even though some of those municipalities might have had two or three times as many people as others. Whereas now in the city of Coral Lakes, for example, when you select a mayor, there's an election and everybody across the whole Coral Lakes district or city get a vote for mayor, and it's not imbalanced in that way. So there's different ways to do this. And I mentioned that I'm going to describe this kind of like a sporting event. Imagine in football, you know, you get 7 points for a touchdown, 6 plus 1 for the conversion, and you get 3 points for a field goal. Well, back at the beginning, somebody could have decided that field goals were worth 2 points or 4 points, right? And so that wouldn't be illegitimate. It would just be different. Now, as you can imagine, the way that teams play the game might be different if a field goal was worth 4 points instead of 3. Might change some decisions sometimes about whether you go for it or not. So it's the same in politics. There's no kind of right or wrong way to do it. But there's just an understanding that we need to have a set of rules, and then we need to at least agree on the rules before we can actually start trying to make this thing function. So when the Americans sat down in 1787, there were two ideas put forward. The states with lots of people in them, like Virginia, said it should be representation by population. The states that had relatively few people in them, like New Jersey at that time, said, no, it should be based on states. Every state should get the same amount. And there was a big disagreement. And quite frankly, the whole meeting almost fell apart at this point, where the big states all wanted one system and the little states all wanted something else. And before the thing fell apart, the delegation from Connecticut put forward a compromise. And it's known as the Connecticut Compromise. And the Connecticut Compromise was, rather than pick one or the other, we'll actually have two. We'll have two levels in our Congress. We'll have two houses in our national legislature, one of them based on representation by population. So that today is called the House of Representatives, excuse me. And the second, we'll have equal membership per state. So each state will get two members in the Senate. And this is still the way it is today. So in the United States, there are 50 states. Each of them have two senators, regardless of population. So California has 40 million people, they get two senators. North Dakota has less than 1 million people, they get two senators. But on the other hand, in the House of Representatives, the seats are allocated by population. So in the House, the California has 40 some seats and North Dakota has one. So this was a compromise called the Connecticut Compromise that kind of saved the day. A little bit of trivia. If you travel in the US, you may notice, you know, on lots of their license plates, it has a little slogan on them. And the Connecticut license plate says the Constitution State. That's why it says Constitution State, because it was actually Connecticut that saved the day and came up with this notion. Now, again, today, we look at this notion of a lower house based on population and an upper house based on membership as kind of normal around the world. But when these guys did it, it was a new idea. They invented this, and it has been subsequently adopted by countries around the world, including Canada. 100 years later, in 1867, when Sir John A. and the rest of them came up with the Canadian government, they took a hybrid model on this. They called the lower house the House of Commons, like in the UK, but they called the upper house the Senate. So it's kind of like the House of Lords in the United Kingdom, but it's kind of like the American system of the Senate. And while we didn't have an equal number of senators per province, it was more equal than the seats in the House of Commons. So, but when the Americans did this, it was a new idea. Another key question that came up in the United States at this time, and this is kind of fascinating, is, okay, so we're going to hand out these seats based on population. Who's going to count the people? And secondly, who gets counted? It might seem obvious, but it's not, right? So when you, who's going to count the people? Well, they decided that they were actually going to create a National Census Bureau, which was also something that's very common today around the world. I mean, I got my envelope to do the census here a couple of weeks ago. But in 1787, this was a new concept, that the government would actually count all the people every 10 years and use that information to manage a bunch of programs, including elections. The second question, who gets counted, is a little more interesting. You count, of course, in those days, it was only men. It's actually only white men that voted over 21 years of age. So who are you going to count? Are you going to count the men? Are you going to count the women? Are you going to count the kids? What about Native Americans? Are we going to count them? Are they citizens? Do they get to vote? There was a significant number of Native Americans kind of relative to the entire population at that time. It was kind of an open question. And more interestingly, in the South, the question was, what about the slaves? Are we going to count the slaves or not? So here's where the ugly compromises of politics, one of the ugly compromises of politics arises. That in the South, the delegations from South Carolina and Georgia and places like that, Virginia, who had slaves, they said, well, obviously we're not going to let the slaves vote, and we're not going to consider them citizens. But when you guys do a head count to decide how many seats we get, we want to count them, right? So I think this is the original have your cake and eat it too, which is that you say, we want to count all the slaves in terms of our head count, so it bulks up our population and we get more stuff from Washington, or we get more seats in the House of Representatives. But on the other hand, we don't want to let them vote. And once again, the whole thing almost flew apart. And there was disagreements in terms of whether slaves should or should not be counted. There probably was less discussion about whether there should be slaves or not, but simply whether they should be counted or not. And at that time, there was the adoption of what's considered the infamous Three-Fifths Compromise. So believe it or not, they agreed that in the states that had slaves, the states in the South that had slavery, that they would count all the slaves, but they would only count as three-fifths people. So if you had 100 white people and 100 black people, you got counted for, in your tally, you got 100 points for the white people. But for the slaves, for 100 slaves, it counted as kind of 60 points towards your population total. So this is the Three-Fifths Compromise that, well, again, was just a completely crass political agreement to try to find something in the middle when one side said zero and the other side said 100 or one, the compromise was three-fifths or 60%. At that time, and I appreciate I appear to be taking a very circuitous route to answering the question, which is how do American elections work? But I trust me, I'm getting there, okay? So then they talked about a president and a vice president. And the question becomes, okay, we're going to have a president and a vice president. And in those days, they actually saw them, the vice president is quite powerful and relatively independent of the president. That's not the way it's worked out over the last couple hundred years. But at that time, they were viewing these as two separate offices that would be kind of separated and elected separately from each other. So then the question again becomes, is it going to be a direct election? You know, where we're going to use the city of Kawartha Lakes model where everybody gets one vote for mayor, or in this case for president? Or are we going to use the old Victoria County model where each of the municipalities gets to send a couple of people to county council, and then it's the county councillors who decide who the warden is, right? So this, again, was another impasse in the room because some of the states wanted a direct election. Again, the states with lots of people in them who thought we'll have a big influence there. Whereas the states with a small population were like, no, hang on a minute, we'll just get swallowed up in this. And what we think won't matter. So again, it went back and forth. And Connecticut, again, kind of stepped up and said, let's use the same model we used for Congress, which is that we're going to say, you know, every state gets members of the House of Representatives based on population, and then everybody gets kind of like two bonus seats in the Senate. So basically, we're just going to add those two numbers together, and that is going to be how many votes or points each state gets. Okay? So if California, if you look at this map, it says 55 on California. So that means that today, California has 53 seats in the House of Representatives plus two, that gives them 55 electoral votes. And if you look at North Dakota up or Montana up along the Canadian border, kind of south of Alberta and Saskatchewan, you can see that they get three. That's the minimum because everybody has two senators and everybody gets at least one member of the House of Representatives. So that's three. So you can't go below three. And the max is just kind of based on how many seats you have. Now, unlike Canada, where we keep increasing the size of our House of Commons, in the United States, they've capped it at 435. So there's 435 members of the House of Representatives. And every 10 years when they do a new census, if they're going to give extra seats to the fast growing states, places like California or Texas or Florida, you have to take them away from states that aren't growing or that are shrinking. So if you look at Pennsylvania or Ohio or Michigan or places like that, that had a, that maybe 40 or 50 years ago had a bigger portion of the national population, they go down. So if you look at this map, you can see that Ohio there has 18. Ohio had 20 some back 20 or 30 years ago. So they have a fixed number. They keep reallocating them, 435. There's 100 senators, so that's 535. And the District of Columbia, which is a capital district where Washington, D.C., District of Columbia is, they don't get any House reps. They're not a state. But at one point, it was decided that they should get three electoral votes, too. They should never have more than any state, but that the people who lived in D.C. should be able to vote for president, too. So they get three. So 435 House reps plus 100 senators, that's 535 plus 3 electoral votes for the District of Columbia is 538. So in order to become the president, you have to get more than half, which is 270. So when you watch American elections, they're always talking about, you know, when will candidate A or B get to 270? That's what it is. That's what that number refers to. So it's an indirect election of president where each state has its own kind of mini election, and then they get to decide how they're going to apportion their electoral votes into that system. And this is still how it works today. So this slide is probably the most important one of those I'm going to show you today. Look at those stern-looking women there. You don't want to mess with either one of those two, I don't think. So it kind of reminds me, even as when I was an MP, when you went into the Elections Canada office, and that you didn't mess with those people in there. They were kind of the referees that ran the place. And I think when they do their training, they're trained to be a little grumpy, okay? So the question is the United States host, who's going to control the rules and the management of the election process? So in a federal election, so when they're actually voting for president and senators and House reps like they do, like they did last November, who makes the rules? In the United States, they have a very, very unusual setup, which is that the individual states control the rules and control those elections. I'm not aware of any other country on earth that does it this way. In Canada, we have Elections Canada that does this, but in the United States, it's the individual states that control the local election. So this explains why when we were all watching the American election last November, you have kind of this crazy situation where, you know, in one state, voting opens at 8 o'clock, but in another state, it opens at 9 o'clock. And in some states, they have mail-in voting, and other states, they don't have mail-in voting. And in some states, you can do mail-in voting, but it has to arrive 3 days before the election. In other states, it can arrive on the day of the election. And in some states, they use paper ballots, and in other states, they use machines. And even the machines in one state are different from the machines in the other state. And to Canadians watching this, this is incredibly confusing. What on earth are they talking about? Like, what are the rules? Well, the answer is, there's 51 different sets of rules, 50 states plus the District of Columbia, and they each have their own rules, and each make their own rules. And so it is incredibly complicated to try to figure out how these things are going. And when you have a close election, it means that the result is often delayed. Let me give you a little example. Historically, mail-in ballots were not widely used. Members of the military or other people overseas, there were some people that might be away on election day. So there always were mail-in ballots, but they were like 1 or 2% of the vote. In recent years, mail-in ballots have become more popular for a variety of reasons, but especially during the COVID pandemic last year, a lot of states wanted to use mail-in ballots so that they didn't have to funnel people through these voting stations. So the problem was that in the past, if a state said, well, we're going to have mail-in ballots, and when do we count them? And most states said, well, let's just set them aside, and on election night, you know, if we only have 700 mail-in ballots, and one of the candidates wins by 9,000 votes, we don't really need to count, like eventually we need to count them. But on the day of, we don't need to count them to figure out the winner, because the election day voting will be the vast majority, and the winner there will be the winner if the total number of mail-in votes that we have sitting in the back room is less than the margin of victory, then they can't change the margin. We're kind of seeing this in the NHL right now. They're trying to figure out how many more games do they have to play in order to figure out what the final result is going to be. But in American elections over the years, this wasn't a big problem until last year, right? So last year we saw states like Texas, for example, in their rules, they count all the mail-in ballots early, like before election day. It's kind of the logic of, we've got nothing to do on the weekend. Let's get our kind of homework done. Let's get this task done now. So on election day, when we're busy, we don't have to worry about it. Other states still had the old rule, which is that, well, we'll set them aside and we'll only count them at the end if we need them. So that's how you got this weird situation that when the voting closed on election night, the Texas results immediately showed several million votes cast. And then they were just waiting for the count of the daily votes. Where in these other states, like in Pennsylvania and Georgia and elsewhere, it took them days to sift through the tens of thousands of mail-in ballots they had received. So it makes for the fact that individual states actually control the rules and the management of the election makes it very confusing and chaotic. And it also makes it very subject to mischief. So now you have 50 different groups of people, each with their own sets of rules, all trying to lever their own advantage. Because in every state, it's either the Republicans or the Democrats in charge. So they kind of try to shape the rules towards something that will favor them. And so this makes being, you know, going back to my football analogy, this makes following American politics like a sport really complicated and very confusing to people that don't actually understand all these rules. As I already mentioned, in Canada, the provincial elections are run by provinces, but federal elections are managed by Elections Canada. So there's kind of one referee in Ottawa. We have here in each riding, there's a chief electoral, a returning officer who kind of runs the local election, and they're kind of in charge. And even the candidates have to kind of do what they're told. But that's how we, at the end of the day, have a result that even if you lose, most of the time, you kind of accept the fact that it was a fair game and that the result is the result, even if you don't like it. The problem with the American system, as we've seen in the last 6 months, is that for those who want to dispute or contest the outcome, they have 100 different arguments that they can make. And it's kind of confusing to try to figure out whether they're telling the truth or not. So anyway, in this regard, I would argue that the Canadian system is clearly superior to what they do in the United States. One of the other things in the United States that was debated way back in 1787 about the length of terms of office. When we have an election, how long are these people going to be in office? The founding fathers decided to stagger the terms of office. In the United States, the House of Representatives, all those folks get reelected every 2 years. So in November, every 2 years, there's an election for House reps. And in the modern world, what this means is the campaigning never stops. So if you're a consultant or you own a company that kind of helps people run election campaigns, this is great because it's never ending work. And so if you watch American TV and says, man, oh man, they just had an election last week or last month, it sounds like these guys are already campaigning for the next one. Well, in the House of Representatives, that's true. They're on a 2 year cycle. The founding fathers 240 years ago never could have foreseen this, that this would just turn into an eternal campaign, but that is what has happened. The president is on a 4 year term. And so if there's an election every 2 years for House reps, every second time, and these are in the years divisible by four. So in 2000, 2004, 2008, 12, 16, 20, there's a presidential election. We call those the on years, and then the off years are the two in between. So 2002, so 2018 to 2022. Next year, there'll be an election again in the United States, but not for president, just for the House of Representatives. So that's fairly straightforward. One small caveat, initially, there was no term limit for presidents in the United States in the Constitution, but George Washington, who was widely respected, he ran twice, won twice, and then he very publicly stepped aside saying, I think that's enough for anybody. And that was respected by subsequent presidential candidates up until the 1930s when Franklin Roosevelt was elected in 1932, reelected in 1936. But by 1940, whether it was because of the World War was going on, even though the Americans weren't in it yet, whether it was because the Depression was still on, or whether it was because FDR just liked being president and wanted to run again, he ran again in 1940. And then in 1944, I think not many were surprised that he ran again, even though he was very ill by that point. And so he actually was elected four times in a row. Subsequently, not long after World War II, the Americans actually passed a constitutional amendment that limits presidents to running twice in a row. So basically you can't run three times in a row, but you can run again. So legally, for example, Bill Clinton or Jimmy Carter or Barack Obama or George W. Bush could all run for president again. So could Donald Trump. You can't run three times in a row, but you, if you've been out, you can go back in. So you might have to invite me back in a few years to talk about that if it happens. The more confusing part of this is the Senate. senators are elected for 6 years. So I already said there's two senators per state. There's 50 states. So that's pretty easy. 50 times two equals 100. But they don't all get elected at the same time. So they're kind of divided up into three groups. So in one election, a third of them, so 33 of them, their term is up, they run. So 33 of the 50 states have an election that year. So maybe in New York, they're voting for one of their two Senate seats that year, but maybe New Jersey next door isn't voting that year, because obviously if there's a cycle of three groups, kind of group A, group B, and group C, and each state only gets two senators, that means on one of those three times, you kind of sit out. So that is what happens in the US, where you have a senator doesn't represent half the state. So you don't have one senator for North Florida and one senator for South Florida. You have two senators that both represent the whole state, but they're not elected in the same year. The idea is to kind of spread it out. And so that's why usually there are a 33, 33, and then 34 Senate elections. Now, what's a bit confusing is that if a senator dies in office, they actually have a special election. And this became relevant this year because in Georgia, it was actually their turn for one of their Senate seats, but the senator in the other seat had died and there was an interim person in that seat, but they had to have a special election. So it's enormously unusual this past year that one of the states actually was electing both senators at the same time. And the fact that the balance in the Senate was 48 to 50 at that time, and both of those seats became very relevant. It's like a solar eclipse, right? Like that kind of thing happens very, very rarely. But it was just part of the craziness of 2020 and the American election cycle. But that's how that happened.
Hello, can my microphone just beeped? Can you still hear me?
Yes, very well.
Okay. So here's a consequence of the system they have in the US and in Canada. Ironically, both of our systems can produce winners to get less than 50% of the vote. So often when we talk about elections, we say, well, if less than half the people voted for you, you're really not very legitimate. Well, it can happen, and it can happen in both countries. In the United States, there have been 59 presidential elections. There have been 13 winners who got less than 50% of the vote. And there's actually five times where the winner got less votes than the winner got less votes than the loser. So the less than 50% is pretty easy. Sometimes there's a third candidate. So when Bill Clinton was running back in the 1990s, Ross Perot ran. So if you have a third candidate that gets 5 or 6% of the vote, that can mean that the other two candidates kind of go like 49, 47 or something like that. So that's how you can get less than 50%. But also in the United States, because people vote within their states and those are translated into electoral votes, you can actually have the situation where the ultimate winner in the Electoral College actually got less votes, a lower percentage of the popular vote across the country. This happened in the United States in 2016 when Donald Trump got 46.1% of the vote and Hillary Clinton actually got 48.2%. Now, as Canadians, don't feel too smug, because in Canada, we've had 43 federal elections, and only twice in Canadian history has the winning party gotten more than 50% of the vote. John Diefenbaker in 1957 got over 50%, and Brian Mulroney in 1984 got over 50%. I tease some of my liberal friends who like to think of their party as the natural governing party of Canada, that in fact, through the entirety of Canadian history, the Liberals have never gotten 50% of the vote, not once. Conservatives have only done it twice, but the Liberals have actually never received more than 50% of the vote. And this, of course, is because we have a multi-party system. So if you have three or four parties running or five parties running, in our system, it's the party, it's in the riding, the candidate that gets the most votes wins. They don't have to be a majority. They only need a plurality. And that is actually what usually happens. And interestingly enough, in 2019, in our last election across the country, the Liberals got 33.1% of the vote and the Conservatives got 34.3% of the vote. But the Liberals got more seats. So that's why they're in power rather than the Conservatives. This happens. It happens fairly regularly. whenever it does happen, there's a big explosion in the media and everybody's wringing their hands like it's the end of the world. But for those who pay attention, this happens all the time. And it happens in sports too. So I'm switching gears from NFL to NHL. So the playoffs are going to start soon. So here's my prediction for the first round of the Stanley Cup playoffs, right? So games 1, 2, and 3, Toronto wins 5-0. Games 4, 5, 6, and 7, Montreal wins 1-0. So at the end of the series, Toronto scored 15 goals. Montreal has scored 4 goals. But guess who wins? Montreal with 4 goals. Because in the end, in hockey, it's not the total goals you score, it's how many games you win. In football, it's not how many yards you gain on the ground, it's how many points you score. In baseball, it's not how many hits you get, it's how many runs you score. So in sports, we deal with this all the time, this kind of apparent anomaly. But it, in fact, it's a product of the rules. We all understand them and we accept them. It happens in politics too. So my conclusion is that an election is a contest, and every contest is conducted under a detailed set of rules. And if you want to understand the contest, you have to understand the rules. And what it also means is that every electoral system, the Canadian and the American, sometimes produce results that seem illegitimate to those that don't understand the rules. So I can go back to my hockey analogy. Montreal scores 4 goals, Toronto scores 15 goals, and yet Montreal goes on, not Toronto. So that can, the same thing can happen here in politics, that sometimes the results seem illegitimate, but only to those that don't understand the rules. Usually, if you understand the rules, then at least you understand how they achieved the outcome. My final point is sometimes as Canadians, we're kind of smug and take, I don't want to say cheap shots at the Americans, but kind of roll our eyes about what goes on down there, the craziness of their elections. The fact that in Canada, political parties rarely get 50%, and our current prime minister didn't even get the most votes in the last election, just means that we, people that live in glass houses, shouldn't throw stones at their neighbors. That kind of wraps up my presentation. Thanks for your invitation to speak today and for your attention. If I can offer a little commercial message here, I now operate a tour company that takes groups around the world, including to South Africa. And in the last 6 months, I've been working with our safari outfitter in South Africa, a company called CD Tours. We have created a program where we're trying to teach high school students in that area, kind of in a rural, poorer area of South Africa, about career opportunities in tourism at the world famous Kruger National Park, which sits right beside them. So basically, we put together, we're working with a local high school and taking kids that are in high school and showing them the different kinds of jobs they can get at Kruger National Park, which is just up the street. I compare this to saying, imagine a poorer kid living in Orlando who's never been to Disney, right? So we want to take these kids on a safari in Kruger National Park, not just to have fun, although it is fun, but just so they can get a sense of what's actually going on there. And most importantly, that maybe when they grow up, they could get a job working there. They could be a ranger or a guide. I mean, they could be a cook or a clerk in one of the shops. They could be a biologist. It's just to kind of make them aware that these opportunities are there. And each person that I take to South Africa, within the company, we contribute $50 to this Careers at Kruger program. And basically, we can sponsor one kid for $50. But also whenever I speak in public, things like today, if I receive any fee or honoraria for my speech, I just want you to know that that money is also donated to the Careers at Kruger program. And I know that the kids, in South Africa would say, thank you. Here's a picture taken last month of a bunch of kids that went on a safari that we paid for, and learned about lots of different jobs. And I'm just noting for you, I know that from time to time, you're actually looking for speakers to speak to your Probus Club. If at any point in the future, you'd actually like me to talk about Careers at Kruger, what we're doing and how we're changing these young people's lives, I would be glad to come back and to talk about that too. So thank you very much. And I will try to answer your questions.